Hello, everybody, and welcome to another edition of the Midnight Mass Podcast. It's me, your old ghoul friend, Peaches Christ, and I'm here with my fantastic, I almost said sidekick again.
How dare you?
And I'm here with my fantastic co-host, the one, the only, it's Michael Verratti.
Well, hello, hello, Peaches, and I hope you have a good place to store your lipstick because we're going to a party tonight.
Oh, I've got just the place, Michael. Do you want to see?
I do.
Really? You want to see my tit? You pervert.
Well, I assume that like you have to go and get it out of the closet.
Fair enough. Yeah. I have to get my boobsforqueens.com breastplate, put it on, and then attempt to ram my lipstick right through the nipple. Why are we having such depraved fantasies, you may be asking yourself. Michael, don't leave them in suspense any longer. And for those people who have not seen this film, that opening conversation probably was really odd.
Well, if you haven't seen this film, you might want to hit pause, go watch it, and come back, because this week we are celebrating 1988's Night of the Demons, directed by Kevin Tenney, written by Joe Augustin, and starring Kathy Podawell, Amelia Kincaid, Linnea Quigley, Hal Havens, Billy Gallo, Donnie Jeffcoat, and an apple or two stuffed with razor blades.
That's right. Well, this movie is one that's been on the Midnight Mass list probably since the beginning. I love this film. I hadn't seen it in some time, but it was fun to rewatch it and remember, oh yeah, this is why 15-year-old me was obsessed with Angela when the movie came out. It's a lot of fun. And we have great guests today who also love this movie. Michael, when did you first see the film? Do you remember?
I do. This is definitely one of those rental era movies for me. I remember seeing the videotape at my local store and bringing it home and immediately being just captured by that animated opening title sequence. It just was very evocative of the era, but also the Halloween season. And what I love is in the years since, anytime I see a horror movie that has that sort of animation opening, I know that somewhere in the heart of hearts of that filmmaker, it's a reference to Night of the Demons. And that brings me joy. This is one of those great Halloween season movies. It's a great goth movie. It's one of those movies that's just like a good party movie, not just because there's a party in it, but it's a fun one to watch with a group of people. And I saw it on VHS and have continued to revisit it off and on over the years. And I'm so glad to be celebrating it here with you today. In fact, I do want to make mention of the fact for folks who are sort of looking at our episode lineup and saying, hey, wait a minute, they're doing Night of the Demons this week, but last week they did Demons. Well, yeah, Peaches and I decided that we were going to just do a March month of Demons.
It's a demon double feature.
The only thing that we kind of failed at is we didn't tell you that we were doing it until now. So.
This is the first time where we've intentionally done a double feature we'd want to see. As far as influence, both have been incredibly influential on me. And if you listen to our Demons episode, you know all about what I mean as far as the influence there. And then, of course, with this episode, it would be hard to not see the connection, especially in early Peaches. I mean, basically, early Peaches was Angela. You know what I'll do for the Patreon, Michael, is I will dig up a bunch of early Peaches photographs where I basically look exactly like Angela from Night of the Demons, but both in demon makeup and without.
Well, I think a great commonality between both of the movies is their excellent use of music. You can't think of Night of the Demons without that Bauhaus number where Angela dances. To me, that moment is so emblematic, not only of this film, but of a certain era of horror, of a certain moment of the 80s, that of course it's iconic. I think that as we discussed with both of our guests over the course of the episode, that moment is epiphanal for so many like young queer fans, young goth fans, horror fans. There's so much there.
Girl, I had that exact strobe light as a kid in the 80s. I had multiple. You would buy that strobe light at a store that no longer exists called Radio Shack. And I remember going to Radio Shack whenever I needed a new strobe light, and it had like faux wood stickering on the sides, and it was just a box with the strobe light in it. And I kind of known of Bauhaus because of The Hunger and was a fan because I was already listening to all that kind of music. But seeing her do that dance to Stigmata Martyr, not only did I probably do it in my bedroom, you know, because I was that kind of queer, you know, a la Darren Stein. Darren Stein's famous for just prancing around her bedroom, doing all the lip syncs to the Go-Go's and, you know, whatever.
Waiting in real time for Darren to text us.
Yeah, Darren loves it when I bring him up on the podcast. But this is an appropriate place because Darren and I are cut from the same cloth. That influence of seeing her in that scene is probably what led me to obsessively needing to get a Bauhaus song called She's in Parties in the movie All About Evil. And if you know the movie All About Evil, you'll know that I did not get my wish. But Steve Kaczynski, the music supervisor, and I tried really hard to get that movie in, so much so that we reached out to David Jay of Bauhaus, who wrote a letter to the publishing company saying that he would like to see his song in this movie. And it still was a quote that was way outside of our budget. So I don't know if they had more money back then when they made Night of the Demons, or if Bauhaus wasn't as expensive. That would be my guess, is that Bauhaus became more expensive over the years.
Oh yeah, I mean, who's to say about the inner workings of the industry from year to year? But what I do know is that Bauhaus has become more influential with each passing year, and Night of the Demons has become more influential with each passing year.
Yes.
And I think this moment and that marriage between those two things is such a benchmark, as I said. I think that Night of the Demons is one of those movies that is so definitive of an era, but also really significant. As we discuss with one of our guests, when you look at the landscape of horror, it's mostly male-dominated in terms of villains. And with the original Night of the Demons, we get Angela, who then continues on to parts 2 and 3, as well as a remake. And she is sort of a icon who stands alone a little bit, because we don't have a female horror villain that got as many movies as Angela did. And the fact that she continues to be sort of a beacon in the goth night for people and for horror fans is really important. And I think we need to put more respect on her name.
On Angela's name?
Yes.
Respect for Angela. But also, let's talk a little bit about some respect for Suzanne. Because Angela, in some ways, she does deserve tons of respect as an icon of horror. But when you think of Night of the Demons, I think typically you think of Angela, right? She was on the poster. She's the villainess of the film. But Suzanne is played by scream queen extraordinaire Linnea Quigley. And oh my God, what a fun, hilarious, fabulous. I mean, this is Linnea just owning every moment. And Suzanne is just wonderful. Now, I'm more of a Angela myself, right? And Michael, who are you? Are you more of a Suzanne, more of an Angela? Are you more of a stooge? Are you the Guido who has plastic furniture coverings at home?
I'm probably Sal, right? I'm the old lady at the end, let's be real.
That's true, yeah. Poor Brendan.
Linnea Quigley is absolutely one of those icons of horror. And this is one of those movies that really cemented her place in the genre. We've got Return of the Living Dead. She's in Silent Night, Deadly Night, Nightmare Sisters, Sorority Babes in the Slime Bowl, Bolarama. She's in the movies of David Dakota. We see her in so many key movies of the 80s. She had her own horror workout tape. And she's one of those people who, because she became so synonymous with horror films of the decade, that when you revisit a movie from the 80s and she's there, it's like a warm booby hug.
That's exactly right. And our first guest today is very clear about it. She's a Suzanne. And a podcast with a few Angelas, I'm not the only one, a podcast episode, it was important to have a Suzanne amongst us. So let's listen to a little bit of this conversation with the riveting and fabulous, direct from last season of RuPaul's Drag Race, it's none other than Lucy LaDuca.
We'll be right back. in a boozy fixation, ecstasy, lying cross-checked in agony.
Welcome back, listeners. Everyone knows that if you're going to attend Angela's Halloween party, you need to turn a fierce and spooky look. Luckily, I think our next guest is very much up for the challenge. One of the superstars of RuPaul's Drag Race season 15, this celebrated drag artist emerged as a fan favorite and was hailed in the press as a contestant who delivered, and I quote, real star power. Also an acclaimed recording artist, if you've been at a queer club or even remotely online in the last year, then you're no doubt aware of this individual's breakaway hit single, Let Loose, which went extremely viral and as of the time of this discussion has been nominated for a Queerty Award in the category of Best Anthem. All this, and it's very much a matter of public record that this person is a devoted fan of all things horror, a drag icon, musical artist, and so much more. It's Lucy LaDuca. Lucy, welcome to the show.
Woo! Do you guys have sour balls? Hi, ghoul friends. How are you?
Good. How are you? What better way to start than a blowjob reference?
Well, listen, know your audience, and I know the podcast that I'm on, so I know I needed to start with a blowjob joke.
Yeah, I love
fair,
it. I love
fair.
It.
So when it comes to Night of the Demons, this is one of those movies that I always kind of consider a staple of the VHS rental era. When people were discovering the kind of 80s horror of the rental shelves, Night of the Demons is one of the first titles that comes to mind. But how did you find this movie? What's your relationship with this film?
So I actually hadn't seen this movie until I was in my 20s. Back in the day, you did have to watch the movies that were on television. And if you've ever seen Night of the Demons, if they were to cut it down for television, it would be about 18 minutes long. So I hadn't seen it until I was laid up. I had surgery because I'm not making this up for the pod. I gave myself a hernia because I corseted too tight.
Oh,
years
God.
Ago. And so I had to have surgery for that. And I was laid up for like a couple of weeks. And so I found it. It must have been on Amazon Prime or something like that. And I saw the cover art, which is just so horrifying as soon as you look at it. And I thought, I have to watch this. And so it was probably about 5 years ago, I discovered it for the first time.
Was it love at first sight? Because this was one of those movies that I saw when it was first released on VHS, because, you know, I was born in the 70s, raised in the 80s. So mom and pop video stores were all the rage. And this actually came out a little bit later. When I think about the VHS titles that were hitting me hard, you know, as far as just discovering the weirdest of the weird, it was such a great era for horror. We all know that. I mean, some of the best movies we discovered were through VHS at that time. And this came out and I fucking loved it, which we'll get into and why I loved it. I was 15 or 16 when this came to VHS. It spoke to me in so many ways. And I was already a goth kid, which I think this movie, you know, really connects with. I mean, we'll get into the Angela of it all. But of course, obsessed with Angela and Linnea Quigley. You know, you've got the best goth girl and the best slut, you know, ruling a Halloween party, right? I mean, just perfection.
Michael already did my intro. Stop talking about it.
So you see it years later. And what did you love about it? Was it funny to see the 80s of it all? Because, of course, I was watching it in real time.
I was not born until 90. However, I have older siblings. I have much older siblings who are 10, 11 years older than me. And so I feel like I've always had a grasp of things about 10 years before my time really well. I've loved things that are super 80s, super 90s. And so this movie, it was love at first sight. The opening credits of this film, I just adored the animation. I love when there's music in the movie where not a single instrument is in sight. It just is all synth. And the animation, I remember, reminded me of like the local carnivals I would go to, and you'd go into the haunt and it would be all that UV paint. It was very reminiscent of that. And so before I even saw human actors or actresses, I was very much hooked on this movie.
I love that you started by singling out the animated intro because it is so special. And I think for a movie of a limited budget like Night of the Demons, this was a smaller budgeted film, to have an intro like that really sets it apart right away. But it also just kind of tells you this movie is a party from top to bottom. You know, we know exactly what we're about to get just from this sort of synth wave goth animation. And then when we finally go into the real world, really the first thing we see is Linnea Quigley's ass.
And I wouldn't have it any other way. I love that Linnea spends this entire movie at about a 45 degree angle. She just leads with her ass the entire movie.
I think that begs the question, just right at the top of the conversation. Are you an Angela? Are you a Suzanne? Are you a Judy?
I think I have bits of each of them, I would say. I am a girl who contains multitudes, and I will not have you categorize me, Michael.
The archetypes in this movie are so hilarious. And that's one of the things that I feel like we're just at the end of that, because the 80s were so great at showcasing high school cliques, right? This is the era of the Breakfast Club where, you know, you've got the archetypes and four characters or whatever. You've got all the John Hughes movies doing that. And I feel like this movie almost says, okay, we're going to have the last laugh and we're going to turn it into a cartoon. And the devices they used by setting it on Halloween night were just so brilliant. Like the buffoonish pig of a fat beer guzzling guy, the preppy hot jock, and then to get to put them in costumes, the uptight, you know, lead in the Alice in Wonderland costume. It's just so great. But I will say that the one that rang truest to me is Angela, where you go, is that a costume or is she just a fucking fierce goth girl? She also, I think, got the best monster makeup.
By far, yeah.
Yeah. I wonder if you can kind of talk about the drag of it all. Because I think if ever there's a drag horror movie, it's got to be this one. I mean, even without the gender delusion, you've got the costuming and the archetypes going for it. So at the point that you saw this, were you already doing horror drag or is this one of the things that maybe led you to it?
I had been doing horror drag really since I started. It's never been my main thing. It's always been something that I like to pull out whenever I sort of feel like it. I would actually say that Suzanne, so Linnea Quigley's character, that was actually much more reminiscent of my drag at the time.
Uh-huh.
I've always loved big blonde hair. I've always loved pink. And I've always loved at least a little bit of a nod to the 80s or 90s. That was like very prevalent in my drag for a really long time. And so, I mean, when I saw the ruffled socks with the pumps, I just was like so in love with that. You know what I mean? But yeah, it's funny that you spoke about the archetypes in this film because it sort of feels like a horror Breakfast Club in a way.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly like you said, there's the jock and there's like the good girl is dressed as Alice in Wonderland. And then the bad girl is sort of like the pink slutty version of Alice in Wonderland, which I thought was kind of interesting. And I hadn't thought about Angela being in a costume. It's never in my head. That's never been a costume. I just assumed that she dresses like that at school because they all call her a freak and everything. So I assumed, all right, that's just her every day.
I think that it's fun that Peaches brought up the drag in terms of the looks. But the thing that I think we have to talk about, if you love this movie, it's a centerpiece for so many people, is the drag number that's in the middle of this film that is that Bauhaus dance routine.
Stigmata mater.
So really, just what's your take on that moment? Because it's both 100% in the movie and 100% out of the movie at the exact same time.
I think that's a perfect way of describing it. What I like about this film so much is that it's so quintessentially late 80s. And a lot of these movies did have just a little dance break right in the middle. And why not have the goth girl do a fire dance? And I did a little bit of research. Apparently, she is credited for choreographing that dance herself. She's a trained dancer. But I've got to think that the director is the one who told her to lift her skirt over her head and show her panties. I don't think that she choreographed that herself. But yeah, it's sort of a moment that everybody remembers from that film. It's very much the highlight of it. And I think you put it just so perfectly that it's in the movie, but it's really not in the movie.
The other thing that I think it's fun to talk about with regard to this movie is sort of the stuff that makes it unique. And upon a rewatch, I think all of us kind of revisited it recently, there were certain things that stuck out to me that I didn't really remember noticing at the time. For example, there is a hero to this film that is a Black man. And yeah. I realized through rewatching it in the era that this came out, we look at a lot of these things on the Midnight Mass podcast, you know, where we look at how movies age. And often a film that came out in this era has things that we would consider very cringy, like unapologetic sort of racism and stereotypes. I mean, you look at those John Hughes movies, you know, we talk about 16 Candles. It's very hard to find a character like Long Duk Dong funny now. You know, it's just like, that's very cringy. This movie actually doesn't have that. The people that are the most awful in this film are the people that kind of I would agree with, you know, are okay, sure, you know. And the hero of the film ends up being a young Black guy. And it occurred to me today, like, that is really cool. And maybe one of the reasons that I really loved the movie back when it came out, because besides Night of the Living Dead, this just really wasn't common at all or something that we saw. So I'm wondering, do you think that some of what makes this movie special are those little things that maybe the audience didn't pick up on? What did you think about the different characters and the uniqueness of the film?
You know, it's interesting. I listened recently to another podcast that was discussing this film, and I actually turned it off because the entirety of the thing was the two guys saying how awful this movie was, how terrible it was, how surface level it was, and all this stuff. And upon my recent rewatch, I also noticed something that I hadn't before that seemed so obvious. Our main character is dressed as Alice in Wonderland.
Mm-hmm.
And I sort of was like, oh, this is like such an obvious nod to her falling down the rabbit hole. And I think it's very much about sex and sexuality, which a lot of these 80s movies are about. It very much demonizes overt sex. And then you've got this virginal character who's just falling into the world. And she's got this boy who's trying to convince her to sleep with him. And now she's surrounded by these demons. And then the Roger, who is the hero, is very openly Christian and speaks right. about his father, who's a preacher, and teaching him how to pray and everything. And so I was very interested in that because I was like, wow, this movie is a lot more deep than people give it credit for, because there's a lot of boobs in it. But sometimes the most intelligent movies can use things like the female body to sort of subvert that idea. And I thought that was so cool. I was like, oh, this movie that didn't even really do very well at the box office is really deep. And it's like kind of making me think something. It's not making me think that sex is bad, but, you know, nothing can convince me that.
And that's what I wanted to ask you about regarding this particular line of discussion, because our two survivors are Judy, who you mentioned her character traits are the purity by way of sexuality, and Roger, whose purity comes by way of faith. So both of their purity is tested, whereas everybody else kind of gives into the base feelings or lack thereof, and they don't survive, and these two do. I think in a post-Conjuring world, this is more common in the horror that we get today, but there's a certain point where in the middle of the movie, we're almost set up to sort of laugh at their prudishness only for them to survive. So I feel like there's this thing where it's both mixed messaging, like the movie invites you to laugh at them, but also is like, yeah, but they're still with us. So maybe their morals are better, ? So what's your just take on all of that?
I think what the film does really successfully is it celebrates each type of person and what their individual life is like.
Right.
Because the party girls seem to have a really, really good time. And the virginal girl, she seems to have a good time too. And she ends up surviving. So I think it sort of just shows how many different types of people there are out there. And I would hope that there's no sort of clear, these are the good people.
Yeah.
But it's very layered. I wonder what your guys' take is on Angela. Like, what is the film telling us about the weird girl, the freak, the goth girl who sort of brings everyone into this because she suggests the seance? Is she a villain herself? Or I don't know what the film's even take is on that.
That was layered. And
yeah,
upon rewatching the film, I said to Michael before we got on, I said, you know, what's nice is when you rewatch a movie and you can kind of put yourself in that position of where I was in my life when I was 15 years old, when this movie came out on VHS. And I was like, very connected to both the simplicity of it, the sort of, you know, cartoon of it all. I mean, it's just a simple haunted house movie on Halloween with a bunch of kids having a party. In some ways, I love the simplicity of it. But the characters do have this nuance where Angela does care about both the dark arts and the other people. And she's not portrayed as just some sort of, you know, serial killer goth girl. She has layers, and you actually feel for her. And just before the demon sort of starts to take over, the filmmaker does a really good job of showing you that these are teenagers and they're real people, and that they have the same pressures that any teenager has. You know, how do you feel about sex? How do you feel about identity? What's your role? Are you the weird girl? But at the end of the day, she didn't want people to get hurt. You know, she's actually concerned about them getting hurt or doing something nefarious. I really like that. And then of course the demon takes over, and then you get to have super fun with her as the goth, the demon version of Angela, or the demon version of the slutty girl, or whatever. It's really actually very clever.
I think that at the end of the day, it's almost like a teenage monkey paw wish, right? You know, they are layered teenagers with the complexities that come with being a teenager. And Angela is interested in these things that are maybe subversive, but she also wants friends, and she also wants friends who like the things that she like, who can't relate to that. So she gathers these people in this place. And that's, of course, because it's a horror movie and because it's a Halloween movie, we know it's going to go wrong, and it does. But all this comes from her just wanting to have some sense of belonging. And she gets her wish, just in a horror movie way. She creates the clique, and she gets the people who are now her people, for better or worse.
Yeah, yeah. That's interesting. You know, I thought when I was watching this past time, I've got to think that Angela was a big inspiration, a big precursor for Nancy in The Craft. That would make so much sense to me. Like, Nancy is the evolved version where she's layered, but she clearly is the villain at the end, you know? And I thought that was kind of cool. I gotta think that Angela was somewhere in the realm of thinking when they were developing The Craft.
Well, Angela's way up there. I love lately, I've seen some memes and sort of fan culture that's giving these goth girl icons their due. And I've seen, like, you know, artists who do collages of like Wednesday Addams with, you know, Lydia from Beetlejuice and Angela from Night of the Demons and Nancy from The Craft. And, you know, if you're an outsider kid, like so many of us were, these young women, we loved them because they sort of gave a middle finger to the jocks and the people that were bullying us. You know, they represented strength. I mean, of course, Ally Sheedy, back to The Breakfast Club. If I could be both Molly Ringwald and Ally Sheedy, I would have been both. But, you know, I identified more with Ally Sheedy, you know.
There's so much power in being the goth girl because you are really putting yourself out there. It's the opposite of the wallflower. It's the opposite of going, oh, no one likes me, so let me just shrink away so that no one can see me. You know, even just the other day, I saw someone who was really outrageously dressed for a Home Goods. And I just thought, that guy has so much strength and courage to be out here wearing that in this Home Goods. And I love those type of people. And I agree with you. I think that the goth girls finally getting the credit that they deserve is very much overdue.
Yeah.
Well, the other thing that I think is important about Angela, because if you look at common discourse about horror and horror history and horror villains, there are an overwhelming amount of men who are the horror icons, Freddy and Jason and Michael, et cetera, et cetera. And very few and far between get women icons, and Angela happens to be one of them. I mean, I think this movie is iconic, but it went on to get two sequels. I mean, I cannot think of another female horror icon who, you know, made it past one more sequel. Mary Lou got two movies. End of list. But we've got Angela here. She's in three movies plus a remake. So I think that she has not yet fully gotten her propers in terms of the bigger boys club of horror villainy. And I just think that's something that's really important to make note of.
Well, this podcast is going to change that. I can feel it. We're going to change the world.
Yes.
After this, she's going to be right next to Pinhead. She's going to be right up there.
This podcast is going to change the face of Night of the Demons and put Angela up there with, you know, actually, you know, it's funny that the other one that keeps popping into my head is Felissa Rose in Sleepaway Camp, is another outsider iconic character that kind of the monster or not the monster. In this movie, of course, we know that she's the monster because she's actually embodying the spirit of an ancient demon. And I'm wondering if We can talk about the device of a demon who gets passed around so that other characters can become the villain. And at some point, the villains actually outnumber the non-villains. That was something I thought, we watching it, I was like, oh, that's really clever and fabulous. It sort of starts as this sort of ghost story, haunted house movie, seance. And then by the end, it's kind of a zombie movie because you've got all these monsters, you know. But I don't know that there's many movies that really do it this way. So what do you think about this device of using this demonic puppet head? Because the puppet really is hilarious, you know.
Love the puppet. Love the puppet. There obviously was a big influence of Evil Dead in this movie. There's, you know.
It's direct theft. I mean, I love this movie, but it's like, whoa. Especially rewatching it, right? You're like, oh my God, this is totally Evil Dead.
But the device of sort of this demonic figure going from person to person, I of course thought, because I always think, because I'm a huge Friday the 13th nerd, I think of Jason Goes to Hell, where people are throwing up this like black slug and then people are eating it. Mm-hmm. And then the guy eats his heart and it's sort of going around. And it's like this demonic murderer is making his way around this town, going from person to person, but then they die or they stop being Jason or whatever. So it's not exactly like that, but I don't know. That popped into my mind.
Before we went on the air, you mentioned that you took copious notes and did research.
Again.
And not every guest does. And so as someone who's a little bit Giles at heart myself, I love some research. So I'm curious, was there something that you ran across while digging into this movie that you were surprised to learn?
I was given the option of a couple of different movies to come and chat with you guys about. And I chose this one because Linnea just always wins for me.
Right.
And I was so impressed with the makeup effects in this film. I just think that they're so well done, and they're done by a guy named Steve Johnson, who famously designed Slimer for the Ghostbusters, who's just like so iconic for me. He and Linnea started dating after they met doing this movie, and they were married for 2 years.
Oh, yeah.
They met while he was doing the cast of her breasts for the lipstick scene.
Wow. Oh, you know what I was thinking?
Isn't that so cool?
I think Linnea might have had the first oobsforqueens.com, you know, breastplate of anyone.
A beautifully made.
Yeah.
I could not believe that it looked that good. And
yeah. And her future husband made it, now we know.
Yes. She put an actual tube of lipstick into her actual breast.
Yeah.
That just like blew my mind. But yeah, I thought that that was a really fun and interesting thing, that this makeup effects artist met, you know, this infamous scream queen, and that they were married for a while. I love that.
Speaking of the lipstick gag, it begs the question, the lipstick goes into the nipple in this movie, but it does return in one of the sequels. So I'm wondering what your relationship is with Night of the Demons 2 and 3, if at all. Do you like those movies? Have you seen those movies?
Hate to say, haven't seen them.
This
could be okay. The beginning.
I know. I'm such a fake fan. Honestly, just don't even publish this episode.
There are so many movies we do with sequels. Mostly Michael's seen them. I'm usually the one who hasn't seen them. Now, you might be like me, where I honestly sometimes have such a strong attachment to an original film. Poltergeist, I could never watch the remake. I knew I couldn't watch it. And some of these sequels, like there's a million Children of the Corn sequels. I haven't seen those movies. I should probably go watch them out of, you know, curiosity. I understand why you haven't seen it. Maybe you're too big a fan to have seen them.
You know what? That's actually exactly what it is. As a horror fan, I am sort of scarred by sequels, I will say. Like some of my favorite movies, Michael and I have discussed The Howling. I love The Howling. I just think it's a masterpiece of a movie. And the sequels, my God, they're dreadful. What happened so much, especially in the 80s, is someone would buy the name and they just make a movie that just happens to have the same name. And I just am not really a fan of when they do that. But Angela is in all three, isn't she?
Yeah, and played by Amelia Kincaid. She returns each time and choreographs a different dance number in each of the sequels.
Oh, mama, I know what I'm doing with my afternoon.
And I might have the details of this a little bit wrong, and maybe you ran across this in your research. But speaking of the choreography, I know that an unexpected visitor to the set of Night of the Demons was Rue McClanahan, because she knew Amelia Kincaid, I think, through the world of choreography. And she came to the set, which I just love the idea of Blanche on set of Night of the
that
Demons.
That is hilarious.
I read this in a couple places online, and I'm just here to say, so Kevin Tenney, director of Night of the Demons, if you're listening and this is wrong, please feel free to shoot a message. But that being said, I had read this enough times that if it's not true, I want it to be true. Like, let's print the legend, right?
Yes.
I want to see the photo.
I know, right? Her with one of the demons.
Yes, exactly. Do you have a favorite kill scene or moment and favorite demon design? But the kills aren't really kills because people don't really die in this movie. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that is true. I mean, I love a good two thumbs in the eyes.
Yes,
I love
that, that's
in
amazing.
Any movie. And I thought that was really well done. I think that my favorite demon design was probably Linnea, because what I loved about her is that she had this big, huge, toothy, like Fright Night style.
Yes, mouth. That's right.
I loved that. And Fright Night is one of my favorite films of all time. So it sort of reminded me of that. And then she also, like, even when she was a full demon, she had a little shadow on. She had a little blue and a little pink. And I love that. That's very much how I would do it.
Her makeup would kind of come and go, which I sort of appreciated. Yes. Like, there would be like moments where it's like, oh, I guess in this shot, she wiped off all her eyeshadow. But, you know, I accept it. I mean, it's all part of the demonology of it all. One thing that isn't really a secret, but something I thought worth noting as far as trivia goes, and talking about high school archetypes, is that the guy who gets his eyeballs pushed in also famously is the same actor who is in the movie Heathers and plays the jock whose father says, I love my dead gay son, you know, later.
Yes.
and really didn't do very many other movies, but I'm kind of surprised because he really, you know, you look at like him playing the jocks in both those movies, and not only was he super handsome, he was good, you know, he played it well.
Yeah, I think that he very much was sort of one of the more based in reality characters, which right. you need those grounding characters. On the other hand, you've got Stooge, the pig-nosed, just horrible, horrible man who called every single woman a bitch 87 times.
Yeah.
He sounded like a drag queen at some point. It's like, come on, girl.
Yeah. We say bitch all the time. Yeah. Like, this bitch put my bitch to shame, bitch.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Before we start wrapping up, there is a plot point that I really feel we need to talk about, and it is the beginning and end cap of this movie with the yes. cranky old man. He's introduced at the beginning, just kind of mad at the world, and then we get that moment at the end with his wife and the apple fritter or pie or whatever it is. What's your take on this? Because speaking of moments that exist sort of outside of the movie, but it's also sort of like that kind of satisfying, like, button at the end of a horror film that just happens to not have anything to do with our central characters.
Like a lot of music videos, I would say, in the 80s and early 90s, there was very much this kids versus adults thing. It's like, we're understood teenagers and these adults are just mean. And there was a lot of that. And so although it had nothing to do with the plot whatsoever, I think it was maybe kind of just like, oh, we really want our teenage audience to feel seen in this, so we're gonna have this cranky old man who doesn't understand them. I don't know how he took a bite of the pie, ingested it, swallowed it, didn't realize that there was a razor blade until she said, oh, by the way. Like, that was a little confusing too. Yeah, I don't know. What was your take on it?
I thought when I was rewatching it was like, oh, it's exactly the kind of thing as a young person, I just loved it and wouldn't have questioned it because of exactly what you're describing. You know, in the era of satanic panic, there was this obviously urban myth that people could put razor blades and candy bars and apples and stuff. And I don't think there's ever been a documented case of that ever happening ever. Hello, you'd be very easy to find, you know, like, who gave me the apple? Oh, that guy who lives right there, you know. I like that it played with that. And the thing I was thinking about was, we don't get that sort of sense of Halloween fandom and love for a while. We get little pieces of it in movies here and there. I think of The Karate Kid and movies where you got Halloween sequences, but you don't get a whole movie that takes place on Halloween until I feel like Trick or Treat, you know, kind of took the idea of the anti-Halloween person or the dangerous Halloween person and
that's one of my all-time favorite movies. Perfect.
I agree. I think, well, maybe we have you back on to talk about Trick or Treat.
Okay, sounds good.
I think it's an underrated classic that genre fans are obsessed with, and somehow it never got the wide attention it deserves. That's another podcast. I found this rewatch to be interesting because I was like, God, that is so random. Yet I know when I was a kid, I loved it. And the razor blades oozing out of his throat, it made no sense. Yeah, it's fabulous.
Yeah.
I'm thrilled with a yay grandma slay ending, you know.
Oh, I have a question about that too. Are we led to believe that she just wanted to kill her husband, or is she possessed by a demon?
I think that is probably open to interpretation. I'm sure that they want you to think she's possessed by a demon, but I don't know if you recall, but one of the opening sequences of 6 Feet Under, or if you even watched that show, is just about a woman who's just tired of listening to her husband, and she just cold conks him with a frying pan. And like, you just watch, she's just like, I've had it with this shit. Boom.
Love that.
And like, I kind of think of this scene as just sort of the end cap of like, she had to live with this guy and she's just like, fuck it. Like, I'm just gonna kill him with his own apples.
They definitely go out of their way to really play up his asshole-ish behavior at the beginning of the movie. So for no other reason, it's like, okay, that grandma just killed him and her husband was an asshole, and there's something satisfying with just the fantasy of like, you deserve to die. But it's a totally different movie.
Totally.
Yeah, it kind of comes out of nowhere.
Yeah.
But it's great, though. I wouldn't change a thing about this movie.
Well, with that in mind, Lucy, having first seen this movie while you were recovering from a corset injury to now, how has your relationship with Night of the Demons changed, if at all?
I would say that I appreciate it more now. As we've said several times during this conversation, upon my latest watch, there's a lot more in it than I thought. I think upon first watching it, there's just so much to take in. The creature design and the dancing, and there's a lot of characters in this movie too. And there's the kills and everything. So it's sort of, it's a mile a minute type of movie. And I think now I just appreciate it more. I especially appreciate the writing. I think that it's so purposefully campy.
Mm-hmm.
For example, one of, I don't even remember which character calls which character, but one of them says, Count Dingleberry, the flaming asshole of Transylvania. I mean,
so good.
What a great line. I love that. And I mean, what really hooked me, I remember the first time I watched it, is when Linnea Quigley's like doing her makeup and she says, I just want to look good for the boys.
Yes. Like, perfection.
It's perfectly written. It is perfectly delivered. I just think it's such a great marriage of camp and horror and time period and fashion and makeup. And guys, I love this movie.
I do too. I know that the listeners, like ourselves, are just excited to have you on the show, and we're excited to get to talk to you. And of course, we focus on Night of the Demons, but like something that to me seems like it would be a horror movie and terrifying is, I mean, you've gone on one of the more recent seasons of Drag Race.
Yeah,
so,
it was 15.
Yeah. So like you're on the last season. The current season is still running. So what's the scariest part of being on Drag Race? And of course, I think it goes without saying that we all loved your Jason Voorhees runway.
Oh, thank you so much. I was really proud of that. I made that whole look. I was really happy with that. The scariest part about doing Drag Race, funny enough, is afterward. I had a wonderful time doing the show, and it's very stressful. It's a lot to pack into a small amount of time. The scariest thing is having to experience it with the audience as if you're watching it with a fresh set of eyes, because although I was there in person, you know, you do have to kind of see what eventually is put together, and it's not necessarily what you experience in real time. And so the scariest thing is watching it back going, and then the fans, they're the best part and they're the worst part. And I hate to say that, but on one hand, they love us so much and they idolize us. And I cry all the time at beautiful messages that I get from people. I get amazing gifts sent to me from all over the world. People send my dog Rocco gifts. He's got gifts from Germany and Spain. And it's so incredible. But at the same time, you have these fans who are so angry all the time with every single thing that we do. And I mean, I could
don't get me started.
I know.
I really have a lot to say about it. I know. But yeah. I just want to gush for a minute. Your fucking looks. First of all, you're so gorgeous, and your your performance. I love the Footloosey moment. You're such a talented performer, and the level of talent, the level of polish it takes to go on that show terrifies me. You know, like. Essentially, I built a career as a performer. Basically, my talent is in producing, writing, directing, gathering mm-hmm. people, putting on big shows. The kind of stuff that just wouldn't be showcased on Drag Race. I look at you and I look at what you brought to that TV show and I'm just blown away, especially because of how young you are.
Thank you. Thank you yeah. for calling me young, by the way. So according to the fans, I am ancient.
Oh, then what am I?
You're dead.
I'm dead. I'm dead. Yeah.
You're dead.
I'm historical. but anyway, I just wanted to gush because we have you here and I know the listeners are going to be really excited that we have you on.
Thank you so much.
My fandom of it all is really still about the talent, all of you that get mm-hmm. on the show. And where I really have to sort of remove myself is the fandom. And that's yeah. just where mm-hmm. I'm at. You know, I used to, you know, even be able to go to something like DragCon and enjoy it. And I don't know, those days are, it's just, well, the fandom's out of control, if you ask me. But we don't need to go there. I mean, that's a whole nother thing.
Maybe to cycle it back to the topic at hand, we can just assume that the ill-behaved ones are possessed by demons.
Possessed by demons.
Kind of are, yeah.
Well, that's right. And you know what, I will say one thing about DragCon, just because you brought it up. DragCon, for me, it is exhausting. It's a lot of work.
Yeah, it's work.
I love DragCon because you're not experiencing the fandom on the internet. You're experiencing them in
right.
person. And
that
you
makes
get
sense.
To see, because for us, it's hard not to focus on the negative. And so when you see a line, when you see people who are so excited to meet you, it just warms your heart. And it makes yeah. me feel much more positive about the overall experience. And it really reminds me that I will have a long career.
Yeah.
And because it's so easy to look at the way we're all perceived online and go, well, this is it. I guess I'm hanging up my hat. I did everything I could.
And that is such an important differentiation. I grew up in a drag culture without the internet, the way that you guys have it. And I don't know how you can separate that, but it's a great thing that you're able to remember that, because in mm-hmm. person, people do not behave the same way that they do. Some people do, of course. I mean, I'd like to think that I'm the same, but you know, we know that a lot of that bullshit, that a lot of those attacks and the hate that any public person is getting is from a coward sitting in a dark place, you know, and they're taking their darkness and thrusting it towards you or whatever. But that in reality, that's not really how people behave and not who, I don't think it's who people really are. It just, when you're online, it can be so overwhelming, you know?
Yeah, I think the thing about the internet, it helps me a lot to have gotten to this point. And believe me, I was not at this point this time last year. It's so freeing to know that no matter what you do or say, people are going to have an issue with it.
Sure.
Yeah, I could literally say, I could tweet out, oh, what a beautiful day today. And someone will go, I looked at the weather in New Haven, Connecticut on Tuesday, and it was only 64 degrees. You know, they'll find a reason.
LaDuca is just airing her privilege for living in a nice, you know, it's like, what?
Exactly.
You cannot win. You cannot win. Rocco. Well,
Rocco, not right now, baby. I love you so much. Come on.
Rocco's giving us the cue.
Sorry, guys.
After all of that conversation of the travails of the internet, I almost hate to ask this question, but, you know, for the listeners who don't know, although I'm sure they do, if people want to be invited to your Halloween party, where can they find you?
They can find me at Lucy LaDuca. That's LOOSEY all over the internet. And actually, some really exciting news. I haven't spoken about this at all yet, but this coming September, I am going to be at the Connecticut Horror Fest.
Amazing.
And it is I'm so excited about this. It's the 10th anniversary of the Horror Fest. It's a huge convention. They told me I'm the first drag queen who will ever be there as, you know, as talent. I will be with the likes of Tony Todd from Candyman and Doug Bradley from Hellraiser, the entire cast of Blair Witch. It's the convention that I've gone to for many years. I met Elvira, my idol, your friend.
My drag mom.
Your drag mom. She's jealous.
I bullied her into finally agreeing to say that.
I love that. Maybe I can bully her on September 21st and 22nd at the CT Horror Fest this year.
Peaches is historical. She's not relevant anymore. You need a new young child.
Right, exactly.
Younger.
Amazing. Well, Lucy, thank you so much for joining us to talk Night of the Demons, as well as spending some extra time talking about your amazing career and letting people know that they can find you at the horror convention in Connecticut and elsewhere. This was a real gift. Thank you for joining us at this spooky old house today.
Thank you so much. I will come back anytime, especially to talk about Trick or Treat.
Yes.
And that was our interview with the iconic Lucy LaDuca. I'm so glad we got to let loose about her love of Night of the Demons.
Can we just talk for a second about how fabulous her drag name is? It's one of those names that on its own, without any meaning attached, is just a great name, Lucy LaDuca. It sounds like something from old Hollywood. But then, and I don't know if our listeners have put it together yet, she's talking about having the shits. Did you know that, Michael? It's about having loose stools.
Is that true? I don't know if that's true.
LaDuca? Lucy? Is that not what her name means?
Well, first off,
did I just make something up? I guess we should have asked her, is your name a reference to having the shits? I thought it was Lucy LaDuca. Am I wrong?
I had heard that it was partially based on her love of Lucille Ball, but that LaDuca...
Oh, no.
LaDuca dance shoes are the shoes worn by the Rockettes, which I know is the reference there.
Oh, my God. Well, I apologize, Lucy LaDuca. I did not... Oh, my God. I'm Googling it. LaDuca is a nod to her Italian heritage. The type of shoe worn in the musical theater. Ms. LaDuca, Lucy, dear friend, dear new friend, please accept my apologies for messing that up. But I'm glad that Michael, see, this is why Michael and I are a good team, because Michael has to say, Peaches, no, her name doesn't refer to the shits. It's a nod to her Italian heritage. And I'm, as an Italian American, I, Michael Verratti, am incredibly offended by what you've just inferred.
Yeah, that's exactly what I just said.
Well, she was fabulous.
She was fabulous.
Oh, I love her. And she's gorgeous. You've seen...
Right, she is a gorgeous queen, and she's a huge fan of horror. I mean, she had reached out a couple years ago because she listens to Midnight Mass. And we knew from Drag Race that she was a big fan. We talked about the Jason Voorhees runway look. But if you pay attention to Lucy's social media, she's always talking about horror movies. She and Rocco, her dog, are watching together. And her obsession with fright films runs deep. She's one of those guests that we probably could have had on for a number of episodes because she's obsessed with so much that it was a real coup to have her on for Night of the Demons and talk about her love of Linnea Quigley, as well as just this party of a movie.
I really, really enjoyed it. And I feel like there are these young performers who I get so much out of their enthusiasm and their excitement and their references. I love that such a young, successful performer has inspiration coming from things like Friday the 13th and, of course, Night of the Demons. So what a treat. It was a fabulous treat. So I introduced Lucy at the beginning of this interview as being the Suzanne of our episode today. And in a world where you can be a Suzanne or an Angela, and Peaches has already made it clear, I'm pretty much an Angela. I don't know that I'm the Angela. And there is one. And I think, Michael, you introduced me to this person, and I am so grateful. How did you discover them?
I saw them dressed as Angela at an event that Amelia Kincaid, Angela herself, was hosting. And when I got home and we had connected on social media, I got to see this glorious run of photographs of this person in cosplay as Angela, as well as other horror icons such as Mary Lou Maloney from Prom Night 2 or Paul Rubens from Buffy the Vampire Slayer. And it was just such brilliantly curated cosplay, lovingly curated cosplay, that I kept up with him and his work. But I always knew that this person loved Night of the Demons. And it's something that he shouts from the rooftops as often as he can. It's Gregory Van Abelaer, and we're talking to him about the film right now. Welcome back, listeners. The very first time I encountered our next guest, it was at a bar event hosted by the star of Night of the Demons, Amelia Kincaid, and this person walked in looking more like Angela than Angela herself. Known for stunning and intricately replicated cosplay of horror icons, this individual doesn't just wear his love of horror on his sleeve, he takes time to make sure the sleeve is right. Additionally, he is the co-host of Fright Court, a horror podcast where unloved sequels get their day in court. And, relevant to this week's topic, he's a created co-writer on the forthcoming documentary, The Party's Just Begun, The Legacy of Night of the Demons. He's a cosplayer, podcast host, writer, and so much more. It's Gregory Van Abelaer.
Thank you so much, you guys. Awesome. So great to be here.
It's so great to have you here because when Midnight Mass, the live event, started way back in the 90s, it was always a total thrill for me when people would dress up as the characters that they, you know, loved in the movie so much. So when Michael shared with me your Instagram and I saw how many incarnations and the flawless job you do being Angela from Night of the Demons, it was like, oh my God, this is perfect because our podcast is about cult fandom and about being a cult fan. And I can think of no better way than cosplay for really showing your love for a movie or a character. So all that being said, you're flawless. And like, when did you first discover this movie and how did you get inspired? Obviously you fell in love with it. Like, tell us your origin story with Night of the Demons.
I had a horror movie upbringing, if you will, but I saw a lot in the theater. Like I saw like Pumpkinhead in the theater and Tales from the Dark Side. And I always would rent movies and you know, I was the only child, you know, for a long time. So a big part of my social life was just me renting movies. Like it was me and that's it, my movies. And so I was BFFs with my cousin Angela, you know, so I was the only child. So it's her and I, we were thick as thieves. And one day her mom came over and they got this poster from the video store. And they're like, Gregory, look, I know you would love this. It says, Angela's having a party. It's Angela. And it was, you know, the Night of the Demons poster. And it really freaked me out. So I was like, oh no, I'm okay. I don't need it. Something I came to regret very soon later. So I finally decided to rent it. And I rented it with part two as well. And honestly, the minute that those credits started, with the music, dun dun dun, I knew what I was in for, and I should have watched it even younger, but I fell in love with it. I fell in love with the characters. It was about Halloween and all the things that could happen on Halloween. And growing up a young queer person, Halloween is like our Christmas because it was, especially back then, it was one of the few times where you could be anything you want and not have to worry about getting any shit from anybody. Right. Yeah, so that was a big part of it too. Just everything you love about Halloween in one film. I was blown away by it. That's, I think, how it started.
When talking about how you have really carved out this niche in the world of cosplay, specifically doing characters like Angela and Mary Lou, so much so that I know Delirium Magazine did an article about you and your cosplay work. I'm curious, you know, you see this movie, you fall in love with the movie and the Halloween of it and the characters of it. But when you're a kid and you're running it, you're not immediately dressing up as the character, I'm assuming.
Right.
So what was the path to that? When were you like, all right, I'm doing this, and this is one of the characters I'm going to be doing?
Actually, that was junior high. I think part three had just come out, or it was about to, and I was really excited about it. And my friend and I were coming up with ideas what we're going to do this year for Halloween. We're going to, you know, get really into it. And I was like, I'm going to do Angela. And it was kind of risque because I was, for the first time ever, I feel, going to like reveal who I really was, you know, what I was really in love with. And it was a tie between Angela and Angelique from Hellraiser, but that was way too elaborate. So I was like, Angela, so, you know, I did the mask and the hair. And so it was Halloween. And I remember it was really interesting because some of my friends liked it, some didn't. You know, it was like, you're a chick. And it was a lot of that kind of bullshit. You know, it like shocked them, which was right. So stupid, you know, like, and it really let me know who was cool with me and who wasn't. And it also let me know to really follow who I am and who gives a fuck what anyone says.
Yeah. And I think it's such an interesting thing when, as young, especially queer people who end up being performers, and especially if we're, you know, playing with gender, I always forget, like, oh yeah, there's this whole thing. It's almost like you come out as gay and then you have to come out again as, you know, being a cross dresser or a drag queen or whatever. I mean, of course, now it's a little different because I think the world has a better understanding of drag, but like, that's a good reminder, you know, it can be quite alienating. But in order to show your love for this film, you donned that dress. Our guest is wearing black lace. Okay. So, you know, I actually was going, huh, I wonder if you identify, you know, as goth. And is that Susie Sue behind you? I can only see her legs. Okay. So I thought I recognized that belt. And so as I've been sitting here, I'm like, oh, much like me, you might come from the goth variety and be inspired by the dark arts, which then makes even more sense why you would be so in love with Angela, because she's such a goth diva. But I'm wondering, like, what came first? Angela and your then entrance into discovering Bauhaus and the world of goth folks? Or were you goth before Angela? Does that make sense?
Yes. Angela came first. And what was really funny was she definitely did. And the funny thing is, even though you always say everyone knew, I wasn't ready to come out yet. And so it took a minute. And so I went to a performing arts high school, and it was all goth kids and like nerds and everything like that. And so one creative outlet to kind of really express how queer I was without saying it was the goth culture. You know what I mean? So I was very goth. It was late 90s, you know, going to Cure shows and stuff. But it was awesome because I got to be as creative as I possibly could while channeling Angela. Mm-hmm. Angela was the driving force, and Susie, the mother of goth. You know.
Yes.
They were my backbones, and they gave me the courage and strength to push things even further. And I realized the more further I did, the more people were accepting. I was afraid they wouldn't be, but and I didn't care. But it was so interesting, the friends I made just being myself. And it was interesting, the whole goth, that was my transition into finally saying, I'm gay. You know what I mean? And, right. And it was like, yeah, and you're wearing 8 pounds of makeup. That came hand in hand. But I owe a lot to Angela and Susie, because that's, especially back then, that's how I modeled my looks, with the big black hair, and I would glue dried rose petals in it and all sorts of crazy, you know. But I always modeled that. And Angela herself looks like a drag queen. She looks like Frankenfurter. You know what I mean? So, like, she was definitely something that I took from, and Susie, you know, that really inspired. They really helped those years, getting lost in all that awesomeness.
Me too.
Yes. I'm goth at heart now, that's for
yes.
sure.
Yes.
Well, and the goth connection to Angela obviously is clear. Anybody who has grown up with this movie, they know the Bauhaus dance. They know that iconography. But what's interesting is, over the course of this episode, our other guest really spoke about their attachment to Linnea Quigley in this movie.
Oh,
and
yeah.
What's really cool is this film presents so many different archetypes that there are many different entry points depending what you're looking for as a viewer or as a horror fan. So we're talking about a lot of the appeal of Angela, but why Angela? Like, why did she stand out to you? Why is this a character that you continue to embrace and want to emulate? Because I think that really goes a long way to explaining your obsession.
Angela, she kind of champions the underdog. I think there's all of us in Angela, really. Like, we've all felt like outsiders, you know, especially, you know, the queer community and anybody, really. Whoever's felt just a little different or just not quite fitting in, not only was Angela that, she didn't care. She found her kind of ragtag group of friends, especially Suzanne, because especially, you know, me, I've always had my girlfriends, my good time girlfriends that were up for anything, which definitely Suzanne was. She was a good time girl, you know, like, whatever you're down for, I'm down. And so that I saw, and even before high school, all that, even as a kid, I tapped into that. And it is, in a way, kind of a revenge story, because, you know, Angela does give the bullies their comeuppance, or, you know? So I think that's a big part of it too. And she commands presence. She's very Tim Curry. Yeah. And she's beautiful. A black wedding dress that takes up the whole room. And she's going to her own party in a haunted house. And she doesn't care who comes and who doesn't. She wants to have a good time and dance to Bauhaus. All of that I tapped into big time.
She's obviously just so iconic and for so many reasons, but I have to ask because I hadn't thought about it before because I've watched this movie a lot. I fell in love with the movie when it first came out, you know, discovering it on VHS back when it was first released. You know, I think this movie might have been one of my big awakenings as far as, I mean, I was pre-goth before Night of the Demons, you know, but I'm a bit older than you. But it was one of those things where I think I realized like, oh no, this is going to be a lifestyle for me. And in that regard, Angela is hosting a costume party. Linnea's in a costume. Judy's Alice in Wonderland. Stooge has got, you know, his pig nose. He's a pig for about 5 seconds. Well, he's a pig in the whole movie, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Is Angela wearing a costume or are those her clothes? Because I think growing up, I always just thought those were just her clothes.
It's her clothes. And that's funny because in high school, Halloween, we just got even like more goth. It was right. Just our regular clothes.
Right. For us, it, like as drag queens or goth people, we used to call Halloween amateur night, right? So I kind of feel like, you know, for Angela, she may have added the veil, you know, but mostly those are her clothes.
It was her Christmas to her, you know, so this was her like big event, you know, where she was going to show off as much as she could and show them how it's done. And she did it. She's like, we're going to scare the shit out of them. And they did. Just where this film has taken me and my friendship with Amelia it's led to. And it's been this ongoing ride. And the fact that more and more people are attracted to this film, it's just the best thing ever. Because I remember when I feel no one heard of it.
Yeah.
Where I was growing up. And now it's on Shudder and all sorts of things. And, you know, and the Blu-ray's coming out and, you know, all that stuff. It's fantastic where this is going.
Well, I'm glad that you brought up your friendship with Amelia because that's something I'd like to ask about. You know, you discover this movie, you start doing cosplay of this character. I mentioned in the intro that I remember first meeting you, I think it was at Revolver. She was hosting a night there and you came dressed as Angela. And it's that interesting thing about connecting with the people who are part of these movies that shape our lives. So could you just maybe talk about connecting with her? Because I think that's very meaningful.
What kind of reminded me too is it's like Peaches with your relationship with Cassandra Peterson. It's funny because it's like we kind of start off there like on our walls growing up. And then the next thing you know, you're doing drag with them. Which is pretty awesome. Talking about, you know, like channeling something to happen, you know. But I met her. It was her first convention that she had done in maybe 15 years. My first convention ever. And it was one of those, I think, Cinderella moments where you meet them, you click instantly. And then we started like talking on the phone and then started doing charity events and then conventions together. And because at that point she had moved to California, she had been away because she's very well traveled. So at this point she was going to be in California for a while. So that's when we started just planning stuff and doing things together. But that's when we kind of opened the door again to Hull House, if you will, and started doing awesome stuff, especially the conventions we started doing together and getting her back in the costume and then doing this, the Party's Just Begun thing with the new documentary. That was great to get her involved in that. And then, so it's just been this kind of roller coaster ride. And she's so caring and cares about animals and just people. She's just such a positive influence on my life. I don't even have enough words.
I totally connect to everything you're saying. I think we as these Uber fans who've been touched so deeply by things, when you get to have that moment where you get to meet your idol and they're not only lovely, and it's not that old, you know, saying of don't meet your idols, but they're actually people that then go on to like further enrich your life in person. It's just a magical, unique thing. And I'm so glad that you have that with her. It's just phenomenal and fabulous. Now, you bring up this documentary. Can you talk a little bit more about that? Because I'm not sure that I even know. I've heard about it, but let us know. What is it all about?
Well, it's called The Party's Just Begun, and it celebrates all four films because it was remade in 2010. As far as I've done, whatever involvement I had with it was the part with Amelia. So we filmed Amelia in kind of, you know, a little set of a Hull House set. And that was one of the first times we got her back in the dress and everything. And she, so I, you know, it's kind of the fourth time she's playing Angela, and she hosts the segments and things like that. It's kind of like Peter Vincent or the Crypt Keeper, just little, every segment she has something to say about it and hosting it. So it was really fun to do. She was really excited to do it. Now we're kind of just waiting for it to finish and come out, right. You know.
It's a coming soon. It's post-production. Okay.
Yeah, it's post-production. But I'm really excited and I can't wait for it to come out.
So when you were talking about when you first rented this movie, you mentioned that you rented it in the same night as renting Part 2. And then you talked about, as you were exploring your goth identity, it was around when 3 came out. So you've referenced the two sequels. And I know from your Instagram and just out in the world that you have done Angela-specific looks for each of the films as well. So a two-parter, if you will. What's your relationship with the sequels? And which of the Angelas is your favorite to cosplay?
The sequels are so fun. And I love Part 3. With sequels and stuff, I really tend to go to the underdog sequel because I usually find something amazing about it, instead of finding something I don't like about it, you know? And Part 3 was really special because I was old enough then for when it was actually new. Because when I discovered 1 and 2, they had been out for a little bit. So 3, I remember reading it in Fangoria and it showed Angela in it and she looked fantastic and terrifying. So it was something I was actually looking forward to. And then to finally see it on the video shelf, which is actually my favorite cover. My favorite is the third one with the martini glass. And then to be asked to do the commentary for the Blu-ray that just came out with director Jimmy Coffin, that was so much fun. I'm honored to be a part of that because I love 3. I hope people catch on to it. It was so obscure forever that I'm glad that it's finally out for people to get, you know, anyone that wants to see it. And it was shot in Canada because at that point, you know, I think the OG Hull House is going to be torn down and it was easier to shoot in Canada at that point. So, you know, it's a little bit different, but I think if you look past that, it's still the same essence. And Kevin Tenney wrote the script, so it's still the same story. As far as looks, Angela goes for a more, in 2 and 3, she's more Hollywood glamorous with like the doll curls. Because at that point, the 80s were over. So she went for more like Joan Crawford. She looked fantastic though. And it's interesting. It's like apples and oranges though. Because the first one, she's Robert Smith running around, which I think epitomizes who she is. But as the sequels go, it only gets better. I love that they just tweak her a little bit, but no one seems to notice or mind really. But at that point, she's almost like a eternal being because she's not human anymore. So I think they had to update her a little bit to be more of a goddess, if you will, a Halloween goddess. And the sequels are fun. Anything that keeps the movies going. I even love the remake, you know, like anything that keeps the franchise on the path. Give me more. It's not going to erase the original.
You are the biggest cheerleader and champion in many ways that I've ever met. And what I love about this film, like a lot of the movies we love at the Midnight Mass podcast, it's not just that we love a horror movie. Like, I'm a huge fan of Freddy Krueger. I'm a massive, massive fan of Friday the 13th and the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. But like, if I'm at a convention out of drag and I want to express myself, I might wear a Frankenhooker shirt rather than a Freddy Krueger shirt because it's going to attract the eye of a deeper commonality or a different level of my tribe. And I feel like Night of the Demons is one of those movies. And so you, through doing your cosplay and celebrating this film, have made it more and more popular per se. But part of what we love, part of its popularity is that it's niche, if that makes sense. Is that not totally popular, you know? And so I wonder, you know, you brought up Kevin Tenney, the director, creator. Has Kevin shown appreciation towards your championing and all that you've done?
He's so funny. We've done conventions together and I love all his dad jokes. And but you know what's funny about Kevin is he's a plethora of knowledge and information on, well, a lot of topics, but especially Night of the Demons. He's so generous and he loves talking about it because that was a good part of his life. You know what I mean? Like, he's proud of it. And I think that's what's so cool about films and cult films. It's half of it is talking about it. It's just so much fun. It gets you back into it. It makes you want to watch it again. And it's a part of the celebration. And he's definitely one of them. You know, some people can be like, oh, well, that was a, you know, like they act like they're over it, you know, or above it a little bit, you know, but he's all about it, as he should be.
So when we think of the era of this film coming out and folks discovering it in Fangoria, of course, always loved to highlight creature effects and gore. And this movie gives us both through the work of Steve Johnson. So I'm wondering if you have a favorite gore piece or creature moment in the first film.
Yeah. Well, the lipstick scene is so hard to beat. And just how they did it, it still looks fantastic. And Linnea had to do it left-handed. So, you know, she had to really sell it. Any little flub, it would have just fucked up. And I think they only made 2 molds. So, like, they had to really get it right. And so that one's fantastic. And honestly, the atmosphere of that film is unmatched. And the house they chose for that film is so magical. It was that Charlie Chapman era of those LA homes in the Adams District that were just huge. You're like, a family lives in this? There's like 20 rooms. And at that point, it was dilapidated and, you know, and it was actually set to be torn down, but it took forever. So they ended up making a couple movies there. And it just loaned itself to what this story is. And it was really capturing lightning in a bottle. And the funny thing is, I don't think they realized it, which I know Amelia has said, if they had known what they were doing, it probably wouldn't have been that good. They were just having fun. They were like, no one's going to see this. Let's let our hair down and have the best fucking time. And it shows, you know, it really does, you know. So the atmosphere is on. It's my favorite Halloween movie that I'll watch anytime.
I mean, it's a pretty great and perfect Halloween movie because it's that sort of like, well, if you can't go to a haunted house in the 80s to hang out with a really fierce goth girl and survive a demon infestation, the next best thing, quite frankly, is watching it on TV. So, you know, it really is that sort of, it's the perfect sleepover movie, the perfect holiday movie. Now, I was surprised to hear you say something about the original. And granted, I love this movie, but I don't know much about it, the trivia, you know, so do feel free to like share any tidbits that you might think are obvious, but like not knowing a lot might be reflective of a lot of the listeners as well, who are fans of the film, but don't necessarily know a lot about how it was made. And you have been friends now with the stars and the creator of the film, but Hull House was torn down and it was a real place. My sense was that like that was all just a set and that there wasn't an actual location.
Something was on their side making this movie because they got this beautiful house. It's actually right by the People Under the Stairs house.
Really?
It's
in
yes, it's like a block away.
Wow.
It's now a Ralph's.
Oh, no.
So if you want to have a Halloween party at Hull House, it'll be in the Ralph's parking lot. But no, it was totally real house. They didn't have to go anywhere. There were so many rooms in it. Some were the dressing rooms, some were the effects rooms. It was huge. Like, it just blew me away. I wish they would have preserved it for some historical, you know what I mean? But they tore it down. And the old man's house at the end of the film, that is down the street. So they were really in this one little section. But what's funny is it was gangland. So they had to have 24/7 security, just keeping people out. It was sketchy, you know what I mean? So they had to keep the actors safe, dressed up like demons and smoke coming from the house. So it was just a crazy time. And the house was 100% real. They didn't have to do too much. I think they put the boards up, obviously, but it was so dilapidated. And I think cats were living, you know, like so it was just abandoned and fantastic. And it was what you see on the screen. It wasn't exaggerated. And it breaks my heart because my soul will ever haunt that place. You know, it's my favorite house besides the Freddy house, of course. But yeah, it was real. And I'm so sad to see it go. But the Canada, the house they used for the third one, that's still there. So one day I'll go see it. That was a 200-year-old house, which added a lot to. I love that house. It's the only one we have. So I'm going to love it. Hull House was real.
Amazing.
You mentioned while you were talking about the location, the old man's house. And one of the things that we talked with Lucy, our other guest, about is sort of our obsession with the end caps of the movie, beginning with the old man and ending with the old man. What's your take on that? Because it sort of exists outside of the movie, but it has this very like Tales from the Crypt sort of Halloween punch.
It sets up the film. And what I love about this end cap is it really shows a lot that can happen on Halloween. Just the lore, the danger, the tricks and treats, if you will. And the fact that she's getting revenge on her asshole husband that she's been with her whole life. You know, happy Halloween, dear, with a little wink at the camera. I mean, how Baby Jane, a little wink, you know, like, it, just fantastic. Like, I think it's the cherry on top of the film. Some people were like, it didn't need it, but yeah, it did. I think it makes it the ultimate Halloween movie with a little bit extra. And it just shows you got the evil demons and spirits, quote unquote, but I think the real shitheads are the humans, you know? The husband was gonna like kill children with razor blades, you know, like that 80s lore, you know? So he was horrible, you know? So it just adds to the little tricks and treats element of the film, which is so special. I don't know. I love it.
I totally agree with you. I think that 80s especially were this time of embracing camp in a lot of ways, and directors who wouldn't necessarily have embraced camp, you know, and also just being weird and like doing, you know, like not following any sort of rules or being
taking risks
and also not being afraid of being uncool or on trend. And I think a lot of horror movies now, although I do think lately it's changing, genre films, I think, are getting back to like originality is being rewarded. But there was this time where it was kind of like, let's just go to the next cookie cutter horror movie where all the beats are the same and all the rules are the same. Even the trailers were all cut together exactly the same way. And you know, whatever, we could get into all the tropes that have been annoying. But that weird bookend to me is like, oh, that's the 80s. It's random. It's just weird. And it's sort of just satisfying. And you don't know why.
Very satisfying. It's kind of emotional because I, you know, obviously to me that sets Halloween for me. Like I like to watch it, especially in the beginning of the month. And that sets my month, what my costume's going to be and what I'm doing. And it just, it's the atmosphere of it. And it's like this little Halloween gift.
Yeah.
I love it. I think it's the perfect ending to a film. And then with the music, I love it.
You know, our other guest, Lucy, she started the interview with, I think, what might be her favorite quote from the movie, which is, "Do you guys have sour balls?" And we talked about how she, you know, identifies with Linnea. I guess that means Lucy LaDuke is a real slut. Yeah. Anyway, I think that's what that means. The movie does have, again, unique to the 80s, ridiculous, hilarious, over-the-top dialogue. I wish young people actually talked to each other like this. But do you have some favorite lines from the movie?
Yeah. I live in a nice house with plastic slip covers on the furniture. Like, just, you know, like, he doesn't get how tacky he is. And, you know, that kind of stuff. And I love the guy that's like, you know, just sets it all up. He knows all the stories. He's the, you know, exposition guy. And Angela and just her, but Linnea, for tonight anyway. Like,
yeah,
I think a big part of this movie owes a lot to Linnea because everything she touches is gold.
Right.
She's very essential to this film and adds that element of just, she's just organically awesome, you know? So like it's my favorite Linnea Quigley movie, that's for sure.
Yeah.
And just showcases how amazing she is. Great. And ahead of her time, she's still the queen of awesomeness.
I love that you mentioned that you watched this movie at the top of October to set your Halloween season.
Yeah.
And I love, you know, all throughout this conversation, you've talked about how this movie has served as different benchmarks in your life. And so to some extent, you have been answering this question all along. But as we're wrapping up, a question I like to ask guests, because cult movies are movies that we carry with us. You know, they're movies that we grow with throughout our lives. From that first night, renting Night of the Demons, to now, how do you feel your relationship with this movie has changed?
It saved me. And cult films in general, like, it's protected me. The time that I felt the most safe in my life growing up was with these movies because they were friends that I could always rely on. They were always there for me. And I felt safe. I felt that they were like my heroes and role models, even the villains. Like I found something in things that went through me with life. So no matter what happened, I know that it's always going to be there for me, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And it's always very comforting to me. And my attachment to the film that has grown over the years, my friendship with Amelia and being very involved with the film, I'm honored and proud to be involved with this series. And I'll always champion it. And I'll always be a part of it. And I'm glad that everyone is involved with it too and loves it. And I just wanted to bring as much joy to people as it has to me, really, because it is a celebration and Halloween is my favorite time of year and it's in my heart. And so is this film.
I know it goes without saying. I think Michael and I would feel the same, but we would love to help you with your mission someday. I mean, if the Midnight Mass podcast ever presented one of our live events and did Night of the Demons, I do hope that you would come and be our special guest in full regalia.
I'm there.
All right. You heard it here first, folks.
Thank you so much for taking time to talk about this movie that obviously means so much to you and so much to so many. For folks who want to keep up with you, whether it be the podcast or your cosplay or other things you're doing, how can they do that?
Gregory Van Abelaar on all the socials. Yes, my podcast, Fright Court. Amelia and myself were just featured in a new book by Jason Paul Collum called They Made How Many? Really fun book, actually. It delves into sequels and all sorts of fun stuff. And Amelia and I will be at the New Jersey Horror Con together August 9th through 11th with the cast. It's a cast reunion. So Linnea, Kathy Podwell. So I'm so looking forward to that. The East Coast is so fun. And I am looking forward to that very much. And yeah, that's how you can find me, folks.
Yay.
Sounds good. Well, thank you again for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. This has been so much fun.
That was our interview with Gregory Van Abelaar. His enthusiasm and pure love for this film came out as joy. I just loved how joyful he was talking about this movie. And I think that that speaks to what you and I first intended this podcast to be, which is really a podcast about the cult of these films. And the cult, of course, is made up by the people who love these films. And if there's a leader in the cult of Night of the Demons, I think it's got to be Gregory.
I absolutely agree. I mean, I always knew about Gregory's Angela looks, but even during the course of the interview, I was learning things that I didn't know about his work to further the gospel of Night of the Demons, and I loved learning it in real time. I had heard about the documentary, obviously, but I didn't know that Gregory had participated in the commentary track of Night of the Demons 3, which I want to seek out and listen to, because his joy and love of this franchise is so infectious that I just want to know more, and I want to know more from him. And that's exactly what the cult leader of a movie like Night of the Demons deserves.
As we know, this is our Demon Double Feature March Madness Demon Month. And with the previous episode, we of course did Bava's Demons. And then we've released on our Patreon a very special Midnight Mini Mass, which is where we have extra content. And we actually put out a special mini mass with a special guest about Demons 2.
That's right. We were joined by filmmaker Alex Birrell to talk all about Demons 2. If you recall, Alex also joined us on our main feed episode to talk about Demons. His love of Lamberto Bava and sticky monsters and theaters and high rises shines bright. And we had to keep the March Madness demonology celebration going with him.
I'm going to reveal something. I've never seen Night of the Demons Part 3. Never seen it. And as Gregory was talking, I was thinking, oh no, this is embarrassing. Like, I need to see this. I've also not seen the remake because I avoided it. Now I need to go watch that as well. Anything that brings more attention to Night of the Demons is A-okay. But he specifically talked about his love for Night of the Demons 3. So what do you think, Michael? Should you and I commit to a Patreon exclusive mini mass and we cover Night of the Demons 3? Don't be a bitch.
All in, and I'll still be okay. A bitch.
Because you were about to say no until I said don't be a bitch.
I was actually going to commit to the bitchery of it all. No, I love this. I love this. I love the randomness of skipping right to part 3.
No, I think that's what even makes it more fun, right? Because yeah. Gregory specifically called that one out.
Yes. Oh, I will say for longtime listeners of the podcast, as well as Peaches and I's various exploits in the world of film and television, one of the cast members of the Night of the Demons remake is none other than Tiffany Shepis, who you remember from our trauma episode, but also appeared with us at in the Chainsaw Awards this last year, as well.
I love her.
Works with me quite frequently. She's in the cast of There's a Zombie Outside. We love Tiffany. And we definitely recommend you check out the Night of the Demons remake. Peaches, I recommend you check it out just to see Tiffany cause some demonic chaos.
Well, I love Tiffany. I love her kids. She has the best kids. She's obviously a great mom. Another person that you introduced me to that I have fallen in love with. I've seen part two, but I might need to rewatch it because it's been a long time to get into part three. And then I'll do the remake also. I'm going to commit to all those things. So look for that coming up on our Patreon. And thank you to everyone who's been supporting the Patreon. It's been fabulous. We've been loading it up with all sorts of content. Recently, we put out a previously only seen once on a live stream online event where I interviewed Nell Campbell and Patricia Quinn, both former guests on this podcast. Wait, has Nell been on this podcast?
She hasn't, but we can pretend.
Then we need to get Nell on this podcast. We have that now loaded up onto the Patreon. Michael has been sharing short films. I've been sharing short films. We've got videos. We've got old articles. We've got new stuff. We're really committed and we're really grateful to all of you who are helping us, quite frankly, keep the podcast commercial free. Because I don't know if you've seen, Michael, but we've been hit up for some commercial advertising. And I don't know, I like listening to our podcast without commercials, unless they're commercials for ourselves, which, by the way, do you have anything that you want to plug? I mean, it's late March, so I know that your feature film, we're all awaiting a premiere announcement, but in the meantime, Fangoria just ran the beautiful poster art, so folks can see that.
The beautiful poster art, which was created by none other than Brendan Haley of Haley Doodles. He did an amazing job on the poster, and I was really thrilled that Fangoria thought to share it for us. And you're right, we are about to hopefully have a festival premiere date to announce for There's a Zombie Outside. But in the meantime, just stay tuned and stay creepy. And as Peaches said, thank you for supporting us so that we can keep our Halloween party going all year round.
There is still time for you to get your asses to Palm Springs this weekend. And join me this weekend for Parts of Pippi, a fundraiser for my friend Pippi Lovestocking, who sadly became a quadruple amputee, but she is just charging forward and grabbing life by its horns. And this will be her return to the stage after suffering this really traumatic, awful event. I'll be hosting, and the evening features a rare screening of the documentary Filthy Gorgeous, which was made in 2005 and stars myself, Pippi, and a lot of other drag queens. It's the story of Tranny Shack, but the story up to 2005. It's going to be a fun, crazy night in Palm Springs. So check out Parts of Pippi and join me over there.
Yes, please do.
Michael, it's just a short drive from LA. So,
I mean, I guess if we're keeping the promo train going, the reason I can't attend is because I will be in Anaheim at WonderCon that weekend doing panels about pop culture.
You can either choose to come to Palm Springs and see me or go to Anaheim and see Michael. You decide.
Yeah.
And if you too are not sure where to put your lipstick after you've drawn a heart on your face and you choose shoving it through your breast, well, then you might be one of the children of the pop war now.
Midnight Mass is created and co-hosted by Peaches Christ and Michael Verratti. The series is produced by Joshua Grinnell, Michael Verratti, and Heather Dunham. The Midnight Mass score and theme music was composed by Andrew J. Sepperly. Midnight Mass is a Peaches Christ production.